And I think the right wing doesn't care about this case because of the drugs, and the left wing doesn't care about the case because of the guns.
Dollars was
on this episode of The Popular Show, we have Arthur Bloom. He's one of the brightest conservative thinkers of our time. He's an up-and-comer in radical right thought. He's an interesting guy, and this is an interesting episode because even though we count ourselves on the left, we found some common ground about the issues of justice and prosecution and government overreach. I think you're going to enjoy this episode. It's a very interesting one, fraught with lots of interesting topics about the Obama administration, the overreach of DOJ, and the way we treat incarcerated individuals in the U.S. I think you're going to like it a lot. Please check us out on patreon.com, The Popular Pod. Take care and enjoy.
And you look pretty clean cut. That's great.
Oh, I got a haircut on Saturday.
Hi. Today on The Popular Show, we're talking to Arthur Bloom about his piece in the American Conservative magazine. The piece is titled "The Knoxville Kingpin Who Wasn't." It discusses a Black NRA member sitting in prison for terrorists that may be missing, maybe the missing link in the Fast and Furious debacle of the Obama administration. That's something we'll get to. I think that that's something that people will find interesting. If you're interested in federal government overreach and civil liberties, this is an interesting case for you. We're going to talk about why some cases don't fit the narrative and why they don't get media attention. And we're going to talk about why you should care about the case. So, Arthur, if you could just give us a brief intro to the case, and then we'll get into the more of the specifics.
Sure. Yeah. I'll start with how I got interested in this particular case. I edited a couple of freelance stories regarding the communication management unit prisons. These are a pretty special type of prison. There are only two of them in the country, and between the two units in Marion, Illinois, and Terre Haute, Indiana, there are less than 200 inmates. And they were created during the Bush administration as a war on terror sort of measure. And they were specifically meant for terrorists. The trouble is, at this moment, about 40%, according to one estimate, of the prisoners there are not actually terrorists. And so what makes these two units very special is they monitor the communications of the inmates on a pretty high level, and in some cases just completely shut them down. And so this is pretty interesting when you look at, there are a couple of, you know, eco-terrorists, there are a lot of Islamic terrorists, honestly. But one of the stories that I'd edited by a freelancer involved an insurance scammer who was being held there. Now, an insurance scammer, there's very little reason for somebody like that to be held in this very special type of prison. And while he was there, he was murdered by a jihadi in the prison. So this is a, you know, prison with violent incidents, despite it being very, very locked down. And there's one, I guess, populist hero who's currently an inmate there. His name is Marty Gottsfeld, and Marty's been writing articles from the unit. He did a couple of stories about other inmates there, and one of them I asked Marty for more information about, and it was this guy, Don Reynolds, who my piece is about. I thought this was a pretty interesting. So Marty has been, he had a piece in The Intercept. He had a, he's been published a whole lot of other places, including InfoWars. He releases his stuff under a Creative Commons license. But the reason he's there, his sentence is 10 years long. And the reason he's there is he was involved in a DDoS attack on the Boston Children's Hospital.
Yeah.
And so he's sort of like a hacktivist type figure of a kind of like, late noughties hacktivist kind of anonymous yeah. type guy. Anyway, you'd recognize the type, very libertarian instincts and,
yeah.
and that kind of
There's,
thing.
It ranges from Weave to Edward Snowden. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So he told me about this case involving Don Reynolds, and I said that I'd like to hear from Donnie, so I guess that message had been communicated, and I got a letter from Donnie just a couple of weeks later, and that letter had the phone number for his parents on it, and so I called them, and I kind of got their story. Now, he's been sentenced to life plus 75 years, And so it's an extraordinarily long sentence, as opposed to like Marty's going to be getting out in a couple of years. So, the charges that Don Reynolds went down on are drug trafficking, money laundering, and weapons charges. And it's an interesting case for a whole bunch of reasons, but I started looking into it a little bit more deeply. I think before we get into any of potential fast and furious connection, it's important to maybe talk about the drug stuff, which one of the things that's very striking about Don Reynolds' case is the multitude of federal law enforcement agencies that were involved. To start at the beginning, basically, the local sheriff's deputies raid a storage unit in West Knoxville, and they find about $200,000 of cash, 40 pounds of Mexican ditchweed, and two AR-15s. And this is eventually connected to Don Reynolds somehow. Basically, there's no evidence that it was actually Donnie's storage unit. But anyway, two confidential witnesses provide the grounds for an affidavit for a raid on Donnie and his parents' house. And the interesting thing is these two raids on this guy's house and his parents' house, they didn't find any drugs. They pulled out all the stops, guys with guns showing up at the door, and they didn't find any drugs. So the drugs he was accused of trafficking were marijuana and cocaine. The only drug evidence that can be credibly linked to him is a wrapper ostensibly for a brick of cocaine that they found in his trash. And who was going through his trash, it turns out it was the IRS. And the lead criminal investigator on this case was also an IRS agent. And the interesting thing about this cocaine wrapper is two different IRS agents told two different stories to two different judges about how they got it. And that's a pretty pretty clear place where the government is being a little bit deceptive. That's important because it's really the only piece of serious evidence linking this guy to drugs. This is a special case for a whole bunch of reasons that goes beyond, I should explain why a person should care about this over and above any other harsh sentence for a drug dealer, right? One is the multitude of law enforcement agencies. Two, it's this incredible sentence. Three, that he's in this terrorist prison. And four, his parents have received an amount, a pretty serious amount of harassment since then, including in 2020, they were visited by two FBI agents who told them to stop trying to talk to the Tennessee Secretary of State. Yeah. So, and then there's also the fact that he's being kept in this place where they're trying to monitor his communication. So my theory is that he's being kept quiet for some sort of reason. Yeah. Why are his parents still facing harassment 10 years after he was sentenced? What's going on there? There's clearly a reason why the government is interested in this case, closely enough to put him in, the top 400 potential prisoners, in terms of security sensitivity, putting him in the special prison. Anyway, so I think that's probably a good place to start. There are other pieces of it too. I can go into some of the characters, but in broad strokes, that's the case.
It's so interesting, the sort of evidence that they used as far as like proving that he was involved in drug trafficking was very funny, because if you went in my garbage right now, you'd find probably all these things. It was a wrapping materials consisting of heat sealed clear plastic, packing tape with grease and coffee grounds contained within. I mean, I drink coffee every day. It's Christmas time. This is something that we're always dealing with. And it was one of those things where you just think, God, that's not really evidence.
Right. And, I think we should also be clear, if what the government is saying about him is true, this guy would have been easily the largest cocaine dealer in Knoxville. Mm-hmm. They accused him of dealing hundreds of pounds of kilograms of cocaine and marijuana as well. And so I guess we could kind of expand a little bit outward. The guy, when it gets to the trial, it makes it even stranger, some of the things that went on. Basically, the main evidence against him in terms of witnesses were cartel informants, people who were having their sentences reduced on much more serious drug dealing charges. What you would expect is if, you know, for instance, you're a guy with no record and I'm like a hardened cartel member, you get busted, what they would do is turn you into a witness against me.
Yeah.
What's interesting is in this case, they did the opposite. They're one of the drug cartel guys who was a witness in this case. He admitted to ordering a hit on U.S. soil. I mean, he's like, you know, pretty serious, hardened criminal. And he walked in and out the front door of the courthouse. And so they're the ones that are saying that Don Reynolds is it's their evidence that Don Reynolds is being put away as a drug dealer. It's on the evidence of basically other drug dealers. Anyway, so I think that's quite important. There are other things too. There's the fact that he has no prior record, the drug stuff is so important, and I think I dwell on it because all of the other charges depend on the drug trafficking charges. Mm-hmm. What he's doing money laundering wise, he owned three businesses. One was an events business. He had a trucking company. He was working on producing music. A lot of those are cash businesses. So the evidence for the money laundering charges are a couple of transactions for used cars that are right under $10,000 and two cash counting machines.
Yeah.
And the cash count, he was in a cash business. The amounts, like I said, the lead criminal investigator on this case was an IRS agent. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the key evidence was bank statements and things like that. And this is a guy who was in the used car business. He was making a lot of payments that are right around that bar of $10,000. Yeah. Now, if you do a transaction of more than $10,000, you have to report it. Mm-hmm. And so if you, for instance, change that amount to $9,800 in an effort to avoid reporting, that's actually a crime. That's called structuring. And so they were getting him on things like that as well. But it all depends on the drug charges as well. And the same thing goes for the firearms charges. If you are found guilty of a drug crime and you have a gun on you, you're basically going to prison. It's an automatic sentence enhancement. Yeah. And that plays into the sentence that Don Reynolds is actually serving, because those sentence enhancements were being challenged in the Supreme Court at the time that he went away. And the judge actually said in his sentencing recommendation that even if these types of penalties are overturned, I want to make sure that this guy stays in prison for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So so all of them depend on the drug trafficking charges, which is why I harp on the fact that the drug evidence is so thin. And we're getting sort of into the Fast and Furious territory now. Yeah, you got the mix.
Can you explain Fast and the Furious just a bit? Think that we have a lot of English listeners and they don't necessarily know the situation with that. And I actually think that many people who are conscientious about government overreach don't know about this. And I think it's really important.
Sure. Yeah. Fast and Furious was, if you were paying attention to politics circa like 2011, 2012, this was a big cause célèbre on the right. What had happened was the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had been letting guns walk across the border, and they were getting into the hands of drug cartels. And the evidence now shows that those guns were used in a whole lot of murders. So the theory of what the ATF was doing, what they said they were trying to do, was rather than it involves straw purchasers. So the name for, or so what a straw purchaser is say I'm not allowed to own a gun for whatever reason. I've got a felony or something. I say to you, now go and buy this gun. I'll pay you for it. That would be a straw purchase, and that's illegal. So they were turning straw purchasers into informants or using them as informants. And then they were letting They were basically letting you pass me that gun rather than making the arrest at the point of the crime being committed. And so many of those guns ended up in the hands of the Sinaloa cartel in particular. So this became a whole big scandal. There were hundreds of guns that were allowed to walk. It became this big scandal because there was a Border Patrol agent who was actually killed with one of those guns. And so, you know, now the Republican Party in Congress is waving the bloody shirt. They're calling for an investigation. I think it was Chuck Grassley that first kind of jumped on the Fast and Furious mm-hmm. case and started, I think, sending out subpoenas. And then there was an Inspector General's report that came out in 2012 that I sort of read it on a whim after I'd been reporting out this Don Reynolds case for a while. And I realized how similar it looked to some of the details that are in here. Now, the types of guns that were allowed to walk as part of Fast and Furious, they were large. Overwhelmingly, there were two types. There was an AR-15 and then the Herstal 5.7, which is a handgun. And Don Reynolds is involved in a AR-15 transaction, or the AR-15s are ostensibly in this unit, and then he's involved in passing a Herstal 5.7, according to the government and according to one of the cartel witnesses. So it's the same guns that were used across Fast and Furious are here in the Don Reynolds case, and there's also a similar. So what happens is this guy, one of the cartel witnesses, Jonathan, I'm blanking on his last name, but he's down in Mexico with Uncle Bustos, who's the boss of the cartel, and the uncle says, I want a Herstal 5.7, and so he calls Don Reynolds and says, can you get me a Herstal 5.7? It's for my uncle in Mexico, And Don Reynolds supposedly, even according to the witness on the stand, says this is actually for you. This is, you know, you can't give it to anybody else. Seems to be trying to follow the law. So that gun, according to the cartel witness, changes hands in Dallas in a transaction that it looks like the government has photographs of. So it would be illegal. That would be an illegal transaction. That is taking place under the supervision of the government that he's not charged with. Nobody was charged with, because the reason why it would be illegal is it happened over state lines. I could sell you a gun if we were both in the same state, but I would need a federal firearms license to sell you a gun over state lines. And so here there is in the trial evidence a illegal transaction that was never charged. That's one of the, and then also I one of the other things that gives me the suspicions about the Fast and Furious case is all of the timelines match up almost perfectly. The Don Reynolds is in Tucson, Arizona, in about 2006, 2007, right when wide receiver is ramping up into Fast and Furious. So he's in the right places at the right times. He's doing business with a auto dealership that seems like it was probably a front of some kind. All the timing matches, the guns match, the type of transaction is the same. There are all these things that gel with Fast and Furious, like quite a lot.
Yeah.
Then to kind of take it back around to Don Reynolds and his sentence, It raises the question of why did they come down so hard on him? What's with this really insane sentence for somebody with no prior offenses and no drug evidence against him? What's going on here? And Don Reynolds claims that he was asked to become an informant. And it looks like the auto dealership that he was doing business with was being run by an informant as well. He was the one who provided some of the evidence for the search warrant. So it was a potentially dirty auto, a car dealer. It looks like they may have been cultivating Don Reynolds as an informant, but he refused. That's one theory. I think it has some strong evidence to support it. For why they came down so hard on Don Reynolds.
Yeah, I think that's something that you see throughout the justice system, and I use the justice system as a I don't like to use that term. I don't believe that there's much justice served by the Justice Department. But, you know, that's one of the things that you see over and over is this sort of, you know, if you don't plead, if you don't become an informant, you get a very heavy sentence. And I think that's very, you know, for people who care about these types of things, I think it's important.
Yeah. And you know, I don't want to, you know, lose my right winger card by talking about racial stereotypes and things like that. But, you know, there's an aspect to this case that you can sort of see why the impression of, you know, prosecutors or investigators or something like that might have been of like a gangbanger. Here's this apparently very successful young Black man who is flashing a lot of cash. He's driving around nice cars. And
the American dream, really, you know.
Yeah. And the trouble is that that's also partly why I think this is an important case to care about. Like, this is a guy who, if his business endeavors had been successful, and there's considerable evidence, so I've spent some time reporting out that he was pretty successful as a businessman. The government claimed that he wasn't. But if his business endeavors were successful, I mean, he was helping other guys get out of the ghetto.
Yeah.
You know, he is, if right-wingers are expecting, you know, for Black America to just support, sort of pull themselves up by their bootstraps, this is exactly the sort of thing that can't happen. The ones that are lifting them up can't get kneecapped like this. And so that's one of the many reasons I think this case is worth paying attention to. Anyway, I'll leave it there for now.
No, I think it's fascinating. I mean, he had a number of businesses going. He had a car dealership business. He had a music business. He had a studio in his basement. And that comes into play later with one of the gun charges.
Yeah. And this wasn't a small operation. I mean, he was doing business with Swizz Beatz, Juice. You know, he was bringing rappers you've heard of to Knoxville. They were making considerable amounts of money every night that they'd book a show like that. So there was considerable money moving through this guy's businesses. Mm-hmm. What the government claimed is that they were all fronts for drugs. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen enough reporting out this story to know that that's not true.
Yeah, I think that's one of the more fascinating aspects of it. One of the key aspects of the case is that he had a money counting machine, which is, you know, I know a number of people who sell tickets to raves and, you know, all sorts of like electronica concerts that they, you know, they have money counting machines, of course, because they, you know, they take cash. And that's not a crime as far as I'm concerned.
Right. But it's become the key piece of evidence that he was doing money laundering. There is a lot to sort through with these businesses. He had a number of different lines of credit. Oh yeah. And that's the other weird thing. So one of these, his immediate trouble started when a Cadillac Escalade was busted, driven by one of his friends, originally his co-defendant Nathaniel Smith in Chicago. And so the car gets busted and it gets handed back over. The car is handed back over to Albert Baugh, who's the car dealer who testified against him, the car dealer he was working with, who then was a witness for the affidavit and then testified against him. So the car was handed back over to Albert Baugh, and Don Reynolds proceeds to sue for it. So this is a guy that the government is claiming has made $5 million in his drug business, and that's why they confiscated his stuff. $5 million in his drug business, and he's filing a lawsuit where, with the potential for discovery in a Knoxville court to get his, you know, the car that was trafficking, you know, drugs in it. That's who would do that?
Yeah.
There are a number of aspects of this where just like, we're not seeing what seems like normal drug dealer behavior from him.
You would avoid the police by any, you know, any means. I mean, you wouldn't be anywhere near the court system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes for some of the government's claims about his guns. When he moved into, according to the government, moved into the cocaine business instead of just marijuana, the government claimed that he purchased a big tripod 30 cal machine gun, World War II replica.
Yeah.
Sitting in his basement, and the government claimed that he was using it to protect his drug transactions. And so if he's scared enough to get this monster of a gun,
Now this is for the listeners, and I think a lot of our listeners are not gun savvy, this is a 4-foot gun that has a feed belt. It's basically what you would use. It basically transitioned from World War I to World War II as far as like trench warfare. It like changed the game.
That's right.
Yeah. It prevented any ability to have this sort of trench warfare because people were too close and they would get sprayed. This is a huge gun, and it's something that, you know, I come from rural Pennsylvania, and I know people who have guns like this, and like they fired them at targets. It's, you know, it's a hobbyist gun, really.
Yeah, it's a very strange type of gun for a drug dealer to have.
Yeah.
If that's what he was. And so he's also, you know, this isn't a gun that you can pick up and move around very easily. It's certainly not a gun you can conceal. and he's meeting these cartel guys ostensibly and using this gun to protect his transactions. So why is he meeting them in his house?
Yeah.
If he's actually scared of them, and moreover, if he's breaking down all of these drugs in his house, why didn't they find any when they raided it?
So
there are a number of the claims made by the government prosecutors in this case just don't make sense from this, you know, common sense. And here's another one. You know, the first time he does business with these cartel guys, the way it's described by the cartel witnesses in the case is they show up in a parking lot, and the cartel guys hand them all these drugs, and the two guys from Knoxville say, "Well, okay, we'll pay you later," and they hand them a couple of guns, and so this is the first time you're ever doing business. And there's like an IOU being exchanged. We'll just get the money later. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And so a number of the prosecutor's claims are kind of like that. The case just clearly doesn't add up. He was not allowed to challenge. So the kind of standard objections when we've gotten this far. So like, why didn't his lawyers bring up any of this stuff? And the answer to that is, I think he got a very poor defense. And then also the judge didn't let certain things go forward, like Frank's hearing to challenge the warrant. Don Reynolds's parents claimed that the warrant was drawn up at their kitchen table. And that's another aspect of this case. You know, whatever your feelings might be about Don Reynolds's guilt, what happened to his parents is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
When their house was raided, they took everything, and everything that was taken was ratified as proceeds from a drug operation and seized.
Yeah. This is a black veteran. His dad is a black veteran.
That's right.
Under the Obama administration.
Oak Ridge National Lab.
Yeah. Yeah. Which
worked at Oak Ridge National Lab for a while.
Which requires a very high security clearance.
Yes, he had a Q clearance. So that's a little bit weird too. According to one person I spoke to, everybody who was a public employee was thrown off the jury. But I haven't been able to confirm that. So in the raid on the parents' house, they took their jewelry, their wine even, pretty much everything. And what wasn't taken in the raid, they've had to spend down on legal fees fighting this case ever since. And it's reduced them to penury. And it's really a sad situation. They've had no restitution, nothing like that. And I think Don Reynolds, I would say, was never really given the chance to present some of the exonerating evidence that exists.
And the other thing that's very interesting about this case is the way the prosecution leaned on the various people who testified. There was a woman, I can't remember her name at the time, but you'll remember this, but she was pregnant with twins. And, you know, I'm a father of twins. I know what that's like. It's, you know, I hate to pull that I have kids and now I know thing, but in this instance, it does apply. That's a very painful and, you know, in some ways, traumatic sort of way to give birth and to carry. You know, being under that sort of situation can be quite scary, and you don't want to cause trauma to people. But in this instance, they used that trauma pretty dramatically to lean on that witness.
Yeah, I think you're referring to Fatima, who was a model that worked for Don Reynolds's business, was there for a couple of car sales. And I talked to her for the story, and that's right. She was spoken to very, very sternly by an ATF agent, assistant U.S. attorney, and one other person who I've been unable to identify. And they basically told her, if you don't finger Donnie as this drug kingpin, we're going to throw the book at you, or you're going to go to prison too. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, you know, they spoke to her in a room with her parents. She broke down crying, and the parents were trying to basically get her to make a false confession.
Yeah.
Thank goodness she didn't. She was asked to appear before the grand jury, and the grand jury declined to indict her. But they were ready to, it seems like, make her part of this, what they claimed was a drug trafficking operation.
Yeah. It was interesting because they said, you know, you'll never see your kids again. And I thought that was, you know, rather brutal and not the type of thing that, you know, encapsulates the idea of justice that we have.
Right. Yeah. And they're trying to do anything that they can to get her to confess.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about like what this means for justice. And, you know, it's I love these cases that are on the edge. I thought, you know, the way that the Rittenhouse case was treated versus the Waukesha case was very interesting. It seems that things that don't fit into a broader narrative about how we do justice or essentially sort of a, you know, and I say this as someone who's a registered Democrat. It said, you know, this sort of democratic sense of what justice is. And this case really seems to fall into that purview, but it hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. Why do you think that is?
Well, so one of the things that that I kind of ran into reporting this out, and I have to confess, I've advocated for on this case in a couple of ways. I've tried to speak to criminal justice reform groups and whatnot. And I think the right wing doesn't care about this case because of the drugs, and the left wing doesn't care about the case because of the guns.
Yeah.
And so that's why it falls between kind of the priorities of either progressive criminal justice reformers or right wing gun rights people. But I do think there are important Second Amendment concerns that are implicated here. He was a Tennessee concealed carry permit holder. You know, these sentencing answers were challenged by gun rights activists that he was sentenced under. The way that this was kind of reported in the Knoxville press, it was like the Scarface of Knoxville. and they especially made hay out of all of these guns. But he seems to have been a scrupulously law-abiding gun owner. He had all of the right passes and permits. He had a gun safe. There's actually an interesting discrepancy about whether the guns were actually in the house when it was raided or whether they were being kept at the parents' house. I'm still sorting through that, but so there's that. And then the right doesn't care about it because they don't care about the rights of you know, once you bring drugs into the equation, you know, that's game over for the NRA.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And it's funny because we've seen a number of instances where these sort of guns rights issues do not come up if the person's Black. And that's, you know, that's disappointing because, you know, it is, you know, whether we like it or not. And, you know, a lot of people on the left don't like it. And actually, if you go far enough left, they love it. You know, the Second Amendment does provide you with the right to bear arms. And in this instance, he was a responsible gun owner. It seems that people are more comfortable with irresponsible gun owners if the narrative fits.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, his wife talked about how they would go shooting together. It was a hobbyist thing. And he also used them as sort of a repository of value. His wife actually during the trial was asked about his interest in guns. And she said, yeah, it's like a woman in a shoe fetish.
Yeah,
he really likes to buy guns. He likes to buy fancy ones and hoping they'll appreciate in value and things like that. So he was like, he was a real gun nut. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense at all. I mean, yeah. I kind of like those sorts of people. But I think another thing, the Fast and Furious aspect of this, to go back to that just for a second, it was a big cause celeb among conservatives for a couple of reasons. One, it kind of speaks to the irresponsibility of the ATF. Two, because of what they were doing, they were turning gun dealers and people who buy a lot of guns into informants. And what that means for kind of the act of buying a gun, is it safe at that point? And that kind of thing. And then also, the Inspector General's report talked about this, how the regulatory and law enforcement functions of the ATF are sort of being muddied. Their job is both as a law enforcement agency and as a regulator. And it's this case that really shows how those two roles can become muddied. They're involved in committing illegal transactions. Is one way to put what they were doing. So that's why I think this case, we never got the full story on Fast and Furious. The Inspector General's report, I think, left a number of pretty big questions. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, we don't really know how widespread it is. We don't really know how big the program was. And then also there's kind of, this is just speculation on my part, but it was reported in Forbes and in a couple of other places that all of this took place in the context of a non-prosecution deal between the Sinaloa cartel and the DEA.
So how
did Fast and Furious fit into that? Because it does seem like most of the guns were going to the Sinaloa cartel. And the deal was, we would prosecute with a light touch the Sinaloa cartel. It makes me wonder, are these cartel witnesses that are showing up in this case that are all getting sentence reductions, is it because of that? Mm-hmm. But the DEA would prosecute them with a light touch, and in exchange, the Sinaloa cartel would provide information on their rivals. Now, were we also arming the Sinaloa cartel at the same time via Fast and Furious? That would be one way to look at what we were doing. Were we arming one drug cartel to go kill the other drug cartels?
It's
the movie Sicario, right?
Yeah. And I think, just to give some, if this all plays into the El Chapo prosecution, and that was a rival cartel at the time, I believe.
Yeah, I forget which one he was.
Yeah, it's super interesting because I think we all know El Chapo because of the Chapo Trap House podcast, but we also need to know it because it's one of the more fascinating sort of cases that's out there. His wife is sitting in a prison in Northern Virginia right now, and she had testified in some ways. It's one of those situations where, we want to stop illegal drugs coming across the border, but at what cost? And I think this case really brings that to light.
Yeah. If this is the ranking of priorities of the Justice Department, to get Don Reynolds instead of the actual cartel guys, that it speaks to some, profound problem. Their priorities are really all out of whack. Especially given, I don't actually think he dealt hundreds of kilograms of cocaine in Knoxville, but even if he did, it would have been his first offense. And also these cartel guys are moving a lot more. So why are they why are they the friendly ones with the government?
Yeah. It's interesting. Why is a black entrepreneur in Tennessee the problem and not, an international criminal syndicate?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to talk just a little bit more about that. I think that that's very interesting. And can you tell us a little bit about where they can find more information about this case and where we can find your work?
Sure. I think I've written the longest treatment of the case. It's at the American Conservative. It was published last November. And It's about 6,000 words long. It talks through most of these issues. I did one follow-up that when I unearthed the lawsuit that Don Reynolds filed to get his Escalade. So there's one follow-up, and then Marty Gottsfeld, the other inmate, you can find his series on the Communication Management Unit prison. There's one part of the series that's about the Don Reynolds case. There hasn't been a whole lot of other talk about it. I've been raising hell. I tweeted at Kim Kardashian and a couple of other people, but yeah. I think this is, I'm convinced that there was a miscarriage of justice here. And I'm also convinced that there's something going on behind the scenes that is like quite sinister. So I do think it deserves public attention.
And for people on the left who maybe not sympathetic to guns or we're Obama fans, I want to say that that doesn't matter. The fact is that this is a case where there's a miscarriage of justice and that we need to look deeper because, you know, as much as we might like the levers of state to provide welfare or, you know, social services, when it becomes the prosecution of young entrepreneurs who are doing their work, I think that we need to think more deeply about that. Arthur, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on.